This is Audible.
From Simon & Schuster Audio, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, by Daniel Yergin. Read by Bob Jameson.
In the decades following World War II, through countless twists and turns in global politics, through the ebb of imperial power and the flow of national pride, one trend progressed in a straight and rapidly ascending line, the consumption of oil. If it can be said in the abstract that the sun energized the planet, it was oil that now powered its human population, both in its familiar forms as fuel and in the proliferation of new petrochemical products. Oil emerged triumphant, the undisputed king, a monarch garbed in a dazzling array of plastics. He was generous to his loyal subjects, sharing his wealth to and even beyond the point of waste. His reign was a time of confidence, of growth, of expansion, of astonishing economic performance. His largesse transformed his kingdom, ushering in a new drive-in civilization. It was the age of hydrocarbon man. The early glimmerings of this new age appeared in 1859, when the first oil well was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania. It began a boom that quickly spread around the world. In 1873, the great Baku oil fields in Russia opened to development. The developers were the Nobel family from Sweden, and later the French branch of the Rothschild family. In 1885, oil was discovered in Sumatra by the Royal Dutch Company. In 1892, the British entrepreneur Marcus Samuel sent the first tanker through the Suez Canal, the beginning of Shell Oil. In 1901, another Englishman, William Knox Darcy, acquired the first concession to drill for oil in Persia. It took 8 years of dry holes before oil was struck there. Mexico's Golden Lane was discovered in 1910. 12 years later, Venezuela yielded its prize at Los Boroso. In the 1930s, the focus shifted to the Middle East again, with discoveries in Bahrain in 1932 and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia in 1938. All of these discoveries had at least one thing in common. They were carried out by foreigners. The companies, primarily American, British, and Dutch, that were reaping the rewards from these overseas explorations were doing it on somebody else's land, in somebody else's country. For about the first half of the 20th century, America remained the world's dominant oil producer. It supplied 2/3 of all the oil used by the Allies during the Second World War. But after the war, as the hydrocarbon age became a worldwide reality, America's dominance began to fade. Simultaneously, a new wave of nationalism swept through the oil-producing countries, and they began to claim their resources as their own. As early as 1938, Mexico established a model for the future when newly elected President General Lázaro Cárdenas nationalized the foreign oil companies operating in his country. A landmark 50-50 deal was struck in Venezuela in 1943, in which the companies and the country became, in effect, equal partners. That is, they shared the profits equally, 50-50, right down the middle. Another 50-50 deal was struck between Aramco, the Arab American oil company, that was made up of Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, and Texaco, and Saudi Arabia in 1950. The following year, Mohammad Mossadegh came to power in Iran, ousting Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. Within 5 months, he had nationalized the oil companies. 2 years later, Mossadegh fell and the Shah returned to power. The oil companies formed a new consortium in Iran, which for the first time replaced the concept of the concession owned by foreigners with a negotiated mutual agreement. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was formed in 1960 in Baghdad in response to the most famous price cut in the history of oil, Exxon's cut of 14 cents a barrel. OPEC was meant to give the member countries the power to defend and to help determine the price of oil. These were all steps in a high-stakes, complex struggle, a struggle for nothing less than world mastery of oil, the most precious resource of hydrocarbon man. It was and is a struggle between countries and companies. Persepolis, the capital of the ancient Persian Empire, was sacked by Alexander the Great in 330 BC and left for over 2,000 years in deserted ruins. In October 1971, it was brought back to dazzling life. Three huge tents and 59 smaller ones were erected on the desolate site. The occasion was what Time magazine called one of the biggest bashes in all history, put on by the Shah of Iran to celebrate the founding of the Persian Empire 2,500 years before. The assembled dignitaries included the President of the Soviet Union, the Vice President of the United States, Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia, 20 kings and sheikhs, 5 queens, 21 princes and princesses, 14 other presidents, 3 other vice presidents, 3 premiers, and 2 foreign ministers. The event was catered by Maxim's of Paris. The menus, created and carried by 165 chefs, bakers, and waiters, all flown in from Paris, were wondrous. To accompany the meals, 25,000 bottles of wine were also flown in from France. The cost of the pageantry and celebrations was estimated at somewhere between $100 and $200 million. When some questioned such extravagance, the Shah could not contain his irritation. "So what are people complaining about?" he asked. "That we are giving a couple of banquets for some 50 heads of state? We can hardly offer them bread and radishes, can we? Thank heavens the Imperial Court of Iran can still afford to pay for Maxim's services." The overall aim of the Shah's grand celebration at Persepolis was to establish himself firmly in the line of Cyrus the Great, the appointed one of God. When Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi took over his father's throne in 1941 at the age of 21, he was immediately plunged into treacherous circumstances. The role of the monarchy in Iran was a totally unresolved question. His father, whom he worshipped, had seized power and crowned himself Shah in the 1920s. Reza Shah had thereafter brought order to the fractious country, begun modernizing at a pell-mell rate, and had subjugated the powerful mullahs, whom both father and son regarded as dangerous and deadly enemies from the Middle Ages. But in August 1941, 2 months after the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the British and the Russians moved their forces into Iran in order to protect the Iranian refinery at Abadan and the supply line from the Persian Gulf to the Soviet Union. Alarmed by rapid German advances in Russia and North Africa, the Allies feared a pincer that would converge in Iran. They deposed Reza Shah, who had shown friendliness and sympathy toward the Nazis, and replaced him with his son. Reza Shah died in exile in 1944. The son was both dedicated to and haunted by his father's memory. He was also struggling to assert his authority in a political system riven by every kind of division, class, regional, religious, and modern versus traditional. The political culture of Iran was chaotic and phantasmagoric, given to wild exaggeration and violent emotion. Only one thing really united the country: hatred of foreigners, and in particular the British. But the British had put Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in power, and he had always to live that down. His celebration at Persepolis was an attempt to legitimize his rule. He was no longer a puppet, a pawn, a mere appointee to his throne. He was now a man of enormous wealth, power, and pride, who was stepping into pivotal new roles in the Middle East and on the international stage. The post-war petroleum order in the Middle East had been developed and sustained under American-British ascendancy. By the latter half of the 1960s, the power of both nations was in political recession, and that meant the political basis for the petroleum order was also weakening. The United States had been mired in Vietnam for several years in a costly, unpopular, and ultimately unsuccessful war. At the same time, anti-Americanism had become a great fashion and a great industry throughout much of the world, organized around denunciations of imperialism, neo-colonialism, and economic exploitation. Americans themselves were deeply divided not only by the Vietnam War, but also by arguments over the lessons of Vietnam, which had to do with the extent and character of America's global role. For some in the developing world, however, the lessons of Vietnam were quite different, that the dangers and costs of challenging the United States were less than they had been in the past, while the gains could be considerable. The United States was a newcomer to the Middle East compared to Britain, which had been involved in the Persian Gulf since the early 1800s, when it first began to put down the pirates plying those waters and established truces in the chronic maritime wars among the sheikhs along the Arabian side of the Gulf. In exchange, the British took on the responsibility of keeping the peace, with agreements that evolved into guarantees to protect the independence and integrity of these various trucial states. But Britain in the 1960s was a country preoccupied with its economic decline and the liquidation of its empire. Great Britain bowed out of the port city of Aden at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. Entirely a British creation, Aden was strategically located on the oil routes from the Persian Gulf and was one of the busiest ports in the world. Now it was in anarchy. As the British governor departed, a military band played, "Things ain't what they used to be." And indeed, they were not. By 1971, the British had completely withdrawn their military presence from the Persian Gulf, to the shock and dismay of the sheikhs and other Arab rulers. Their departure from the Gulf in November 1971 marked the most fundamental change in the Gulf since World War II, and meant the end of the security system that had operated in the area for over a century. It left behind a dangerous power vacuum in a region that supplied 32% of the free world's petroleum, and that, at the time, held 58% of the proven oil reserves. The Shah of Iran, as he had demonstrated the previous month with the great celebration at Persepolis, was eager to fill the vacuum. The safety of the Persian Gulf, he said, had to be guaranteed, and who but Iran could fulfill this function? The Americans were not happy to see the British go. But if not the British, there was the Shah. This was, after all, the era of the Nixon Doctrine, which attempted to deal with the new political and economic constraints on American power by depending upon strong, friendly local powers as regional policemen. No one seemed better fitted to play that role than the Shah. Though the fact often went unrecognized, there was no other obvious choice. Soviet arms were flowing in large volumes into neighboring Iraq, which had its own long-held ambitions for hegemony over the Gulf and its oil. From here on, a very different security system would reign over the Gulf. The 1970s also saw a dramatic shift in world oil. Demand was catching up with available supply, and the 20-year surplus was over. As a result, the world was rapidly becoming more dependent on the Middle East and North Africa for its petroleum. The late 1960s and early 1970s were the watershed years for the domestic U.S. oil industry. The United States ran out of surplus production capacity, which had provided the security margin during World War II and during previous oil crises, including the 1956 Suez Crisis. But the surplus capacity was erased by rising demand, low investment because of low prices, and relatively low discovery rates. Now there was an eager buyer for every barrel of oil that could be produced in the United States. 1970 was the year that American oil production reached 11.3 million barrels per day. That was the peak, the highest level it would ever reach. From then on, it began its decline. In March 1971, for the first time in a quarter century, the Texas Railroad Commission allowed all-out production at 100% of capacity. "We feel this to be an historic occasion," declared the chairman of the commission. "Damned historic, and a sad one. Texas oil fields have been like a reliable old warrior that could rise to the task when needed. That old warrior can't rise anymore." With consumption continuing to rise, the United States had to turn to the world oil market to satisfy the demand. Quotas on imported oil, originally established by Eisenhower, were eased, and net imports rose rapidly from 2.2 million barrels per day in 1967 to 6 million barrels per day, 36% of total U.S. oil consumption, by 1973. The disappearance of surplus capacity in the United States would have major implications, for it meant the security margin upon which the Western world had depended was gone. The result was an ever-increasing reliance upon the oil of the Middle East. Between 1960 and 1970, free world oil demand had grown by 21 million barrels per day. Two-thirds of that huge increase in oil consumption was being satisfied by the wells in the Middle East. Another significant shift was taking place in the industrial countries. Man's view of the environment and his relationship to it were also changing, with the paradoxical effect of both increasing the demand for oil and regulating its use. Beginning in the mid-1960s, environmental issues began to compete successfully for their place in the political process in the United States and elsewhere. Air pollution prompted utilities around the world to shift from coal to less polluting oil, adding another major stimulus to demand. the impact of environmentalism on the energy balance was manifold. The retreat from coal was accelerated, and reliance on cleaner-burning oil grew. Nuclear power was bruited about as an environmental improvement over the combustion of hydrocarbons. But then in January 1969, the drilling of an offshore well in the Santa Barbara Channel encountered an unexpected geological anomaly, and as a result, an estimated 6,000 barrels of oil seeped out of an uncharted fissure and bubbled to the surface. A gooey slick of heavy crude oil flowed unchecked into the coastal waters and washed up on 30 miles of beaches. The public outcry was nationwide and reached right across the political spectrum. The Nixon administration imposed a moratorium on California offshore development, in effect shutting it down. However great the need for oil, the leak increased opposition to energy development in other environmentally sensitive areas, including the most promising area in all of North America, the one most likely to stem the decline in American production and counterbalance rising dependence on the Middle East, Alaska. The day after Christmas 1967, a joint Arco-Humble venture struck oil at Prudhoe Bay on Alaska's North Slope. About 6 months later, a step-out well, drilled 7 miles from the discovery well, confirmed that this was a great structure, a world-class oil field. For the oil companies, it was a triumph over tremendous physical obstacles, a fiercely hostile environment, concrete-hard ground, a complete lack of roads. Now they face the challenge of getting the oil to market under very difficult conditions. Lots of suggestions were considered: a monorail, a fleet of trucks in permanent circulation on an 8-lane highway across Alaska, a fleet of nuclear-powered submarine tankers, jumbo jet tankers. But finally, it was decided to build a pipeline. Construction of the pipeline posed a host of engineering challenges that would require a great deal of innovation and ingenuity. But the group organized to build it, composed primarily of ARCO, Jersey, and BP, was in a hurry to get it done. They rushed out and bought 500,000 tons of 48-inch pipe from a Japanese company. They didn't think there was time to wait for American manufacturers to gear up. They were wrong. The pipeline was to come to a dead halt before it even started. It was slowed by claims by Eskimos and other Alaskan natives, and by wrangling among the partners. But it was completely stopped by something entirely different, a federal court injunction won by environmentalists in 1970. The still-eager oil companies, confident that they could overcome the opposition, brought in $75 million worth of Caterpillar trucks and trailers to a staging point on the banks of the Yukon River, ready to start building roads and laying pipe. The trucks and tractors and stored pipe were not to move for 5 years. The prohibitions on the pipeline remained in effect. That meant that there was still only one place to turn for the additional supplies required to satisfy the world's almost insatiable appetite for oil, the Middle East. It was just before dawn, one day toward the end of August 1970, when a chartered French Falcon jet entered Libyan airspace. Soon it was on the ground at the airport at Tripoli. The door of the jet opened, and a short, stocky man, just turned 72, stepped out into the early light. He was a very worried man, so worried that he had flown virtually nonstop from Los Angeles, landing in Turin only long enough to change jets. He feared that he was about to lose what he called his shining star, his company's richly prolific oil concession in Libya. But as always, he tried to be confident. His life had been devoted to making deals, and he believed firmly, as an article of faith, that, as he once said, there's nothing worse than a deal that wasn't closed. The man was Dr. Armand Hammer, chairman of Occidental Petroleum. One of the 20th century's great dealmakers, he'd even done business with Lenin in the early 1920s, Hammer had built Occidental into one of the world's leading energy companies. In 1965, in the thick of the mad Libyan oil rush, Occidental won concessions there with a bid that stood out from the 119 others. Under Hammer's personal supervision, the bid had been done up on sheepskin manuscripts and was wrapped in red, black, and green ribbons, the colors of the Libyan flag. The blocks that Occidental won covered almost 2,000 square miles of bleak, gravelly, scorched desert in the Sirte Basin, more than 100 miles from the Mediterranean coast. The first few holes drilled there were dry, but in the autumn of 1966, Occidental struck oil, one of the most prolific deposits of oil in the world, and became, in Hammer's words, one of the big boys. Yet this sudden giant was very vulnerable, owing its very success to its lopsided dependence on Libya. Libya's leader, King Idris, was old and frail. But still, U.S. experts predicted political stability in Libya for at least 5 or 6 years. They were wrong. A group of radical young military officers led by the charismatic Muammar al-Qaddafi seized power from King Idris on the first day of September 1969. Since their teens, Qaddafi and his associates had modeled their lives and their cause on Gamal Abdel Nasser and his book Philosophy of Revolution. The group was enthralled to the Nasserite vision of Arab unity. A born conspirator like Nasser, Qaddafi was also eccentric and erratic, with the wide mood swings of a manic depressive. He intended to make himself not only the leader of, but the very embodiment of the Arab world. In doing so, he would plot and campaign endlessly against Israel, Zionism, other Arab states, and the West, and equipped with huge oil revenues, he would become banker, sponsor, and paymaster for many terrorist groups around the world. In January 1970, officers of the Revolutionary Command Council launched their offensive with a call for an increase in the posted oil price. Qaddafi warned the heads of the 21 oil companies operating in Libya that he would shut down production if necessary to get what he wanted. Initially, much pressure was put on SO Libya. The military government asked for a 43-cent a barrel increase in the posted price. SO offered 5 cents. The companies were not about to budge. Most of them had alternative sources. So the Libyans turned to the one company that did not have any alternatives, Occidental. As one Libyan explained, it had all its eggs in one basket. After months of increasing pressure from the Libyans and long weeks of intense negotiations, Occidental reached a deal. The Libyans got a 30-cent increase in the posted price and a hike in Libya's share of the profit from 50 to 55%. By the end of September, virtually all of the oil companies had given in, though with immense reluctance. The Libyans solemnly promised that they would stick to these new agreements for 5 years. But what had happened was of far greater significance than a price increase. The Libyan agreements decisively changed the balance of power between the governments of the producing countries and the oil companies. Libya's victory reopened the oil exporting countries' stalled campaign for sovereignty and control over their oil resources. For the companies, it was the beginning of a retreat. Speaking of the new agreements, the Jersey director who had responsibility for Libya said, "The oil industry as we had known it would not exist much longer." The Shah of Iran was certainly not going to let himself be outdone by some upstart young military officers in Libya. In November 1970, he broke through the old 50-50 profit-sharing barrier and won 55% of the profits from the consortium companies. And with that, a game of leapfrog began. Various other countries and OPEC as a whole demanded a larger share of the profits. Then at the beginning of 1971, Libya jumped over Iran and made new demands. Obviously, the game could be endless unless the companies established a common front and succeeded in sticking with it. Winning an antitrust waiver from the U.S. Justice Department, the oil companies set about to create a united front. Eventually, 24 companies, American and non-American, representing about 4/5 of free world oil production, joined in. The companies also created the Libyan safety net, a secret understanding that if any company had its production cut back because it had stood up to the Qaddafi government, the other companies would provide replacement oil. On January 15, 1971, the companies hurriedly dispatched a letter to OPEC, which called for a global, all-embracing settlement with the oil exporters. The aim was to maintain a united front and to negotiate with OPEC as a whole, rather than with individual exporters or subgroups as OPEC wanted. Otherwise, the companies would be endlessly vulnerable to leapfrogging. But the Shah resolutely opposed the company's plan for an all-embracing settlement because, he said, the moderates would not be able to restrain the radicals, Libya and Venezuela. But if the companies would only be reasonable and deal with the Gulf countries separately, the Shah promised a stable agreement that would be kept for 5 years. If the companies tried any tricks, he added, the entire Gulf would be shut down and no oil would flow. The companies thought that they had the support of the U.S. government in their struggle with the Shah. but then they learned that Washington had acquiesced to the Shah's position. The companies concluded, however reluctantly, that they would have to give up their insistence on the all-embracing approach. There was no longer a choice. They agreed to have the negotiation split. Otherwise, there would be no negotiated settlement at all. The exporters would simply decide prices on their own. At all costs, the companies needed to maintain the pretense, even if it was only a pretense, that the exporters negotiated matters with them, rather than simply deciding things themselves. So now, there were to be two sets of negotiations, one in Tehran and one in Tripoli. On February 14, 1971, the companies capitulated in Tehran. The new accord established 55% as the minimum government take for all the Gulf countries and raised the price of a barrel of oil by 35 cents, with a commitment to further annual hikes. The exporters gave their solemn promise, no increase for the next 5 years beyond what had already been agreed. A few days after the Tehran agreement, discussions began in Tripoli between the companies and the Mediterranean oil exporters, with Libya very definitely in charge of the negotiations on the Arab side. Over the next several weeks, the Libyans resorted to bluster, intimidation, revolutionary sermons, and threats of embargo and nationalization. On April 2, 1971, agreement was announced. The posted price was raised by 90 cents, well beyond what would have been implied by the Tehran agreement. The Libyan government had increased its oil revenues by almost 50%. The Shah was beside himself with rage. Once again, he had been leapfrogged. The pledge of 5 years' stability in the Tehran and Tripoli agreements proved to be illusionary. Within months, a new and momentous conflict ensued. The battle was over the issue of participation, the acquisition by the exporting countries of partial ownership of the oil resources within their borders. If the exporters won that battle, it would mean a radical restructuring of the industry and a fundamental change in the roles of all players. For the most part, oil operations outside the United States had been based on the concession system, the history of which reached back to William Knox D'Arcy and his bold and blind venture into Persia in 1901. Under the concession system, the oil company contractually obtained rights from a sovereign to explore for, own, and produce oil in a given territory. But now, as far as the oil exporters were concerned, concessions were already a thing of the past, holdovers from the defunct age of colonialism and imperialism. For them, it was a question of sovereignty over their own natural resources. Everything else would be measured against that objective. Outright nationalization had been an obvious resort for some exporting countries, and now others proceeded to nationalize the holdings of the oil companies. Still others, led by Saudi Arabia, sought participation as an alternative to nationalization. Shared or partial ownership would maintain a relationship with oil companies and preserve access to their marketing systems. In October 1972, a participation agreement was finally reached between the Gulf states and the companies. It provided for an immediate 25% participation share, rising to 51% by 1983. But despite all the OPEC endorsements, the application of the agreement was less popular in the rest of OPEC than Saudi Arabian oil minister Ahmed Zaki Yamani had hoped. Algeria, Libya, and Iran all stood outside it. Kuwait's oil minister approved it, but the Kuwaiti parliament rejected it, so Kuwait was also out. The Aramco companies had finally agreed to participation with Saudi Arabia because the alternative was worse, outright nationalization. The chairman of Exxon said hopefully that he expected more stable future relationships to result from the agreement, which maintained the essential intermediary role of the private international oil companies. Others were not so sure. After Yamani's deal with Aramco, Libya took over 50% of the operations of Eni, the Italian state oil company, and then proceeded to expropriate the holdings of the American independent Bunker Hunt altogether. Standing with Uganda's brutal dictator Idi Amin Dada by his side, Gaddafi proudly announced that by taking over Bunker Hunt, he had given the United States a big hard blow on its cold, insolent face. Just moments before 2 p.m. on October 6, 1973, on Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish holidays, 222 Egyptian jets roared into the sky. Their targets were Israeli command posts and positions on the eastern bank of the Suez Canal and in the Sinai. Minutes later, more than 3,000 field guns opened fire along the entire front. At almost exactly the same time, Syrian aircraft launched an attack on Israel's northern border, followed immediately by a barrage from 700 pieces of artillery. Thus began the October War, the fourth of the Arab-Israeli wars, the most destructive and intense of all of them, and the one with the most far-reaching consequences. The armaments on both sides of the conflict had been supplied by the superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. But one of the most potent weapons was unique to the Middle East. It was the oil weapon, wielded in the form of an embargo, production cutbacks, and restrictions of exports, that, in the words of Henry Kissinger, altered irrevocably the world as it had grown up in the post-war period. The embargo, like the war itself, came as a surprise and a shock. Yet the pathway to both in retrospect seemed in some ways unmistakable. By 1973, oil had become the lifeblood of the world's industrial economies, and it was being pumped and circulated with very little to spare. Never before in the entire post-war period had the supply-demand equation been so tight, while the relationships between the oil-exporting countries and the oil companies continued to unravel. It was a situation in which any additional pressure could precipitate a crisis, in this case, one of global proportions. 1973 was a watershed year in the post-war struggle for mastery of oil. For the first time, American oil production had reached 100%. It wasn't keeping up with demand. This meant that America's oil fields were no longer the supply of last resort and could no longer shield the West against the Middle East's oil weapon. The changing conditions in the marketplace, which with each passing day made the Arab oil weapon more potent, coincided with significant political developments. Saudi Arabia's King Faisal, once completely opposed to the idea of embargo, was changing his mind. Faisal was as opposed to Israel and Zionism as any other Arab leader, but he repeatedly rejected his fellow Arabs' calls for use of the oil weapon. He knew that his country was tied very closely to the United States in an economic and strategic relationship that was fundamental to his kingdom, not only for prosperity, but for security. He feared the spread through the Arab world of radicalism, which challenged the legitimacy of kingship. But America became dependent on Arab oil much sooner than expected. In 1973, Saudi Arabia had graduated to the position once held by Texas. The Desert Kingdom was now the swing producer for the entire world. In addition, Anwar Sadat, Nasser's successor in Egypt, had garnered Faisal's sympathy and eventually his support. Sadat was not a radical pan-Arabist. He was an Egyptian nationalist who was trying to escape from the suffocating bear hug of the alliance that Nasser had made with the Soviet Union. Without Saudi support, Sadat might be forced to revert to the Soviet connection, and the Russians would thereupon use every opportunity to expand their influence throughout the region, which was exactly counter to Saudi Arabia's interests. By the spring of 1973, Sadat was strongly pressing Faisal to consider using the oil weapon to support Egypt in a confrontation with Israel and perhaps the West. The Yom Kippur War began on the same day that OPEC delegates and oil company officials met in Vienna to renegotiate oil prices. 6 days later, the negotiations ended with no agreement. Meanwhile, the U.S. sent vital supplies to Israel to avert their defeat in the war. On October 20th, Saudi Arabia announced the embargo. It would cut off all shipments of oil, every last barrel, to the United States. That same day, Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who had been appointed to investigate the Watergate scandal. The event became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Throughout the clash of arms in the Middle East and the weeks of crisis over oil, Richard Nixon was thoroughly entangled in Watergate. The United States had seen nothing remotely like it since Teapot Dome. The unfolding of the Watergate saga during the October War, the country's obsession with it, its effects on the war and the embargo, on American capabilities, and on perceptions within the United States, all interacted to create a strange, surrealistic dimension to the central drama on the world stage. Too much seemed to be happening. The media and the public mind were overloaded. But Watergate and the president's predicament had direct and major consequences for the Middle East and for oil. Sadat might at least arguably never have gone to war had a strong president been able, after the 1972 election, to use his influence to open a dialogue between Egypt and Israel. An undistracted president might also have been able to address the energy issue with greater focus. And once the war began, Nixon was so preoccupied, his credibility so diminished, that he could not provide the presidential leadership required for dealing with the belligerents, the oil exporters, and the explicit economic warfare against the United States and the Russians. For their part, foreign leaders could not comprehend this strange Watergate process, part ritual, part circus, part tragedy, part thriller, that had gripped American politics and the American presidency. Oil prices continued to rise at the same time that Richard Nixon's presidency sank into the morass of Watergate. Seeking to restore confidence both in the economy and in his leadership, Nixon called for a grand new national undertaking, Project Independence. Its goal was to eliminate U.S. reliance on foreign energy sources by the end of the decade. To call his plan ambitious was a considerable understatement. It would require many technological advances, vast amounts of money, and a sharp swerve away from the new road of environmentalism. His staff had told him that the goal of energy independence by 1980 was impossible, and suggested it was thus silly to proclaim. Nixon overruled his staff, for energy was now both a crisis and high politics. It was a bleak time, seemingly the beginning of an age of shortage. The oil embargo precipitated one of the gravest splits in the Western Alliance since its foundation in the days after World War II. The European allies, led by France, hastened to disassociate themselves from the United States as fast as they could, and to assume positions more agreeable to the Arabs. As French President Georges Pompidou bluntly told Henry Kissinger, "You only rely on the Arabs for about a tenth of your consumption. We are entirely dependent upon them." Oil prices rose from $2.90 a barrel in September to $11.65 in December. In America, the gas lines were the most visible symbol of the embargo, as well as the country's most direct experience of it. The Yom Kippur War ended on October 22nd, just over 3 weeks after it had begun. In March of 1974, the oil embargo was lifted, but its effect had been dramatic. The international order had been turned upside down. Oil prices were at the heart of world commerce, and those who seemed to control oil prices were regarded as the new masters of the global economy. OPEC's membership in the mid-1970s was virtually synonymous with all the world's petroleum exporters, excepting the Soviet Union. And OPEC's members would determine if there was to be inflation or recession. They would be the world's new bankers. They would seek to ordain a new international economic order, which would go beyond the redistribution of rents from consumers to producers to one that established a wholesale redistribution of both economic and political power. They would set an example for the rest of the developing world. The member countries of OPEC would have a significant say over the foreign policies and even the autonomy of some of the most powerful countries in the world. It was not surprising, therefore, that a former Secretary General of OPEC would one day look back on those years, 1974 through 1978, as OPEC's golden age. Yet nostalgia certainly clothed his recollection. To be sure, the OPEC countries did in the mid-1970s complete the acquisition of control over their own resources. There would no longer be any question about who owned their oil. But those years were dominated by a bitter battle not only with consumers, but also within OPEC, about the price of that valuable resource. And that one question alone would dominate the economic policies and international politics of the entire decade. The quadrupling of prices triggered by the Arab oil embargo and the exporters' assumption of complete control in setting those prices brought massive changes to every corner of the world economy. The combined petroleum earnings of the oil exporters rose from $23 billion in 1972 to $140 billion by 1977. The exporters built up very large financial surpluses, and the fear that they could not spend all the money created grave concern for the world's bankers and economic policymakers. The unspent tens of billions sitting idle in bank accounts could spell serious contraction and dislocation in the world economy. They need not have worried. The exporters, suddenly wealthy and certainly far richer than they might have dreamed, embarked on a dizzying program of spending, industrialization, infrastructure, subsidies, services, necessities, luxuries, weapons, waste, and corruption. With the avalanche of expenditures, ports were clogged far beyond their capacity, and ships waited weeks for their turn to unload. Vendors and salesmen for all sorts of goods and services rushed from the industrial countries to the oil-exporting nations, scrambled for rooms in overbooked hotels, and elbowed their way into the waiting rooms of government ministries. Everything was for sale to the oil producers, and now they have the money to buy. Transactions in armaments became a huge business, but weapons were only part of the contents of the vast post-1973 cornucopia, which included everything from consumer goods to entire telephone systems. The proliferation of Datsun pickup trucks in Saudi Arabia was a sign of the times. "It is very expensive to maintain camels," said one executive of Nissan. "It is cheaper to keep a Datsun." In total, the massive spending of the exporting countries, combined with the galloping inflation of their overheated economies, ensured that their financial surpluses would soon disappear. And disappear they did, completely, the bankers' initial fears notwithstanding. In 1974, OPEC had a $67 billion surplus in its balance of payments on goods, services, and such invisibles as investment income. By 1978, the surplus had turned into a $2 billion deficit. For the developed countries of the industrial West, the sudden hike in oil prices brought profound dislocations. The oil rents flooding into the treasuries of the exporters added up to a huge withdrawal of their purchasing power, what became known as the OPEC tax. The imposition of this tax sent the industrial countries into deep recession. The U.S. gross national product plunged 6% between 1973 and 1975, while unemployment doubled to 9%. Japan's GNP declined in 1974 for the first time since the end of World War II. As the Japanese worried that their economic miracle might be over, sobered students in Tokyo stopped chanting "Goddamn GNP" at demonstrations and instead found new virtue in hard work and the promise of lifetime employment. At the same time, the price increases delivered a powerful inflationary shock to economies in which inflationary forces had already taken hold. While economic growth resumed in 1976 in the industrial world, inflation had become so embedded in the fabric of the West that it came to be seen as the intractable problem of the modern age. The group that suffered the most from the price increases were those developing countries that were not fortunate in having been blessed with oil. The price shock was the most devastating blow to economic development in the 1970s. Not only were those developing nations hit by the same recessionary and inflationary shocks, but the price increases also crippled their balance of payments, constraining their ability to grow or preventing growth altogether. They suffered further from the restrictions on world trade and investment. The way out for some was to borrow, and therefore a goodly number of those OPEC surplus dollars were recycled through the banking system to these developing countries. Thus, they coped with the oil shock by the expedient of going into debt. But a new category also had to be invented, the Fourth World, to cover the lower tier of developing countries, which were knocked flat on their backs and whose poverty was reinforced. OPEC itself became an international spectacle of the first order in the mid-1970s. The eyes of the world fastened on its meetings, with their drama, pomp, and commotion. Ears eager for any clues about what would happen to the world economy strained to hear the quick response of a minister to a shouted question as he swept through a hotel lobby. Following in OPEC's wake, oil talk, differentials, seasonal swings, inventory build, now became the parlance of government policymakers, journalists, and financial speculators. During this period, most of the exporters were producing virtually at capacity. The exception was Saudi Arabia, which was setting its production in order to try to achieve its price objectives. There was much criticism of the oil price increases in the industrial countries, but the real issue was what would happen in the future. The central concern of the consuming countries in the years 1974 through 1978 came down to a simple question. Would the price of oil continue to go up, or would it be held more or less steady and thus eroded by inflation? On the answer to that question would depend, among other things, economic growth or collapse, employment, inflation, and the direction of the flow of tens of billions of dollars around the world. Though OPEC was commonly said to be split between radicals and moderates, this same question was also the focus of a running battle between the two largest producers in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. It was not a new rivalry. In the 1960s, the two countries had competed over which would produce the most oil. Now the two nations struggled over price and primacy. For the Shah, the December 1973 price increase had been his great victory, and very much a personal one. From then on, he saw his moment and opportunity, the prospect of seemingly endless revenues, provided as if by divine intervention to fulfill his ambitions to create what he called Iran's great civilization, and by the way, solve Iran's mounting domestic economic problems. "One of the only things my husband likes in life," said the Empress in the mid-1970s, "is flying, driving boats, speed." The Shah applied his passion for speed to his entire country in an attempt to hurtle Iran into the 21st century. In so doing, he would ignore the agitation and disorientation that such rapidity caused, as well as the resentment and unhappiness among the many who did not share his obsession with modernity. Iran, the Shah proclaimed, would become the world's fifth-largest industrial power. It would be a new West Germany, a second Japan. "Iran will be one of the serious countries in the world," he boasted. "Everything you can dream of can be achieved here." Cut off from reality by the huge infusion of oil money, the Shah became consumed by his ambitions and dreams. He also began to believe all the imperial trappings. Who would dare disagree with the Shah to counsel caution, to be the messenger of any bad news? And finally, there was the Shah's pride. All the humiliations of the past could now be laid to rest, all the jibes turned around. "There are some people who thought, and perhaps some who still think, that I am a toy in the Americans' hands," he said in 1975. "Why would I accept to be a toy? There are reasons for our power which will make us stronger. So why would we be content to be someone else's cat's paw?" But as he pushed for further price increases, the Shah collided with his neighbors across the Gulf. The Saudis had never approved of the scale of the December 1973 price increase. They thought it was too large and too dangerous to their own position. They feared the economic consequences, and they had been alarmed to find themselves losing control over OPEC and over the basic decisions about oil, which was so central to the kingdom's existence and future. It was not in their interest to perpetuate the cycles of recession and inflation that would be stimulated by further increases in oil prices. Owing to the size of their oil reserves, the Saudis had a decisive stake in the long-term markets for oil, in contrast to Iran. The Saudis feared that higher prices and the expectation thereof could set off a move away from oil to conservation and to other fuel sources that would change and contract the long-term market for oil and thus diminish the value of their reserves. They also worried about the effects of further price hikes on their own domestic social fabric and the political stability of the industrial and developing world, because such instability could in due course come to threaten them. There was still another concern in Riyadh. Iran, the Shah, they were sure, was too short-sighted in his drive for higher prices, too fired by his own ambitions. Further oil price hikes would only provide Iran with still more money and power, enabling it to buy even more weapons, thus shifting the strategic balance and encouraging the Shah to claim hegemony over the Gulf. Why, the Saudis asked, were the Americans so obsessed with the Shah? In August 1975, the U.S. ambassador to Riyadh reported to Washington that Zaki Yamani had said that the talk of eternal friendship between Iran and the United States was nauseating to him and other Saudis. They knew the Shah was a megalomaniac, and that he was highly unstable mentally, and that if we didn't recognize this, there must be something wrong with our powers of observation. Yamani sounded a warning. "If the Shah departs from the stage, we could also have a violent anti-American regime in Tehran." For their many and various reasons, political and economic, the Saudis purposefully and forcefully pursued their line against further price increases at meeting after meeting of OPEC. In all these Saudi maneuvers, the spotlight fell on one man, Ahmed Zaki Yamani. To the global oil industry, to politicians and senior civil servants, to journalists and to the world at large, Yamani became the representative and indeed the symbol of the new age of oil. His visage, with his large, limpid, seemingly unblinking brown eyes, and his clipped, slightly curved Van Dyke beard, became familiar the planet over. But in the quest for simplification and personalities, and also in response to the opaque political structure of Saudi Arabia, the world sometimes confused his role and ascribed greater power to him than he had. He was, in the final analysis, the representative of Saudi Arabia, albeit an enormously important one. He could not dictate or solely determine Saudi policy, but he could shape it. His style of diplomacy, his mastery of analysis and negotiation, and his skill with the press all gave him decisive influence. His power was augmented by simple longevity, the fact that he ended up being there longer than anyone else. While Yamani was widely known as Sheikh, the title was, in his case, an honorific, assumed by prominent commoners, which he was. Yamani was born in Mecca in 1930. Both his grandfather and his father were religious teachers and Islamic lawyers. This combination of learning and piety shaped Yamani's outlook and intellectual development. Yamani's considerable intelligence was recognized early in Saudi schools. He went off to university in Cairo and then to New York University Law School, followed by a year at the Harvard Law School, where he studied international law. He also developed an intuitive grasp of the West, and of the United States in particular, and of how to communicate and be comfortable with Americans. When he returned to Saudi Arabia, he set up the first law office in the country. He worked as an advisor to various government ministries, and he wrote the contract for the 1957 concession with Arabian Oil, the Japanese consortium, which helped to break the major's hold on the Middle East. Yamani's commentaries on legal issues for various newspapers attracted the attention of a most valuable patron, Prince Faisal, second son to Ibn Saud, the founder of modern Saudi Arabia. Faisal invited Yamani to become his legal counselor, and in 1962, when Faisal emerged triumphant from the power struggle with his brother Saud, one of his first acts was to install the 32-year-old Yamani as oil minister. By the time of the 1973 embargo, Yamani had already been oil minister for 11 years and had developed considerable experience and skill and superb negotiating talents. His voice was soft, forcing adversaries to strain and to be silent to hear what he said. He almost never lost his temper. The angrier he got, the more quiet he became. Flamboyant rhetoric was not his style. He went logically from point to point, dwelling on each long enough to draw out the essence, the connections, the imperatives, and the consequences. It was all so simple and persuasive and so overwhelmingly obvious and irrefutable that only a maniac or a simpleton could disagree. It was a manner of presentation that was mesmerizingly irresistible to many and absolutely infuriating to others. Yamani carefully crafted his mystique. He was the master of patience and of the unblinking stare. When required, he would just look at his interlocutor, without saying a word, fingering his ever-present worry beads, until the subject was changed. He was always playing chess, carefully pondering his opponent's position and how to get where he wanted. By nature, Yamani was also cautious and calculating. "I can't bear gambling," he said in 1975 when he was at his apogee. "Yes, I hate it. It rots the soul. I've never been a gambler, never." In oil politics, he insisted, he never gambled. "It's always a calculated risk. Oh, I calculate my risks well. And when I take them, it means I've taken all necessary precautions to reduce them to the minimum possible, almost to zero." Yamani generated strong reactions. Many thought him brilliant, a diplomat of high order, with a broad, superb grasp of oil, economics, and politics. Some in OPEC itself and in the Arab world hated him, either resenting his prominence or regarding him as too close to the West, or simply thinking he was given too much credit. Yamani was very much a Faisal man, devoted to the king who had chosen him. The king, in turn, regarded Yamani as a favored protege and rewarded him with extensive grants of real estate, which skyrocketed in value during the oil boom and were a basis for Yamani's personal fortune. Yamani's close, intense relation with the king gave him carte blanche in making oil policy, though always under the final control of Faisal, and always within lines defined by the royal family, whose most prominent member when it came to oil policy after the king himself was his half-brother, Prince Fahd. In March 1975, Yamani accompanied the visiting Kuwaiti oil minister to an audience with King Faisal. A nephew of Faisal followed the party into the little reception room, and as the Kuwaiti knelt before the king, the nephew stepped forward and fired several bullets into Faisal's head, killing him almost instantaneously. Afterward, some said that the murder was the revenge for the nephew's brother, who had been slain a decade earlier in the course of leading a fundamentalist attack on a broadcasting station to protest the introduction of television in the kingdom. Others said the young man had been caught up in the miasma of the extreme left. Still others simply said he was deranged. Then in December of that year, the international terrorist known as Carlos, a fanatic Marxist from Venezuela, led five other terrorists in an attack on a ministerial meeting in the OPEC building on Karl Lugerring in Vienna. Three people were killed in the first few minutes. The terrorists took the oil ministers and their aides hostage and eventually embarked on a harrowing air journey, flying first to Algiers, then to Tripoli, and then back to Algiers, threatening all the way to kill the ministers. Again and again, they said that two people had already and absolutely been sentenced to death. Jamshed Amouzegar, the Iranian oil minister, and Yamani, who was their number one quarry. On the tense flights, Yamani spent the time playing with his worry beads and reciting to himself verses from the Quran, convinced that he would soon be a dead man. 44 hours after the initial assault in Vienna, the ordeal finally came to an end in Algiers with the suspension of the death sentences and the release of everyone, including Yamani. Some thought that a faction in one of the Arab governments had provided assistance to the terrorist and may have even promised a large reward. After 1975, Yamani became understandably obsessive on the subject of security. And after Faisal's assassination, he never had the independence on oil that had previously been his. Faisal's successor was his half-brother Khalid, who already suffered from a heart condition and did not project himself as a strong leader. Fahad became crown prince and deputy prime minister. He was also the chief policymaker when it came to oil and the person to whom Yamani now reported. To the outside world, Yamani still was the number one figure. But within Saudi Arabia, it was the careful, cautious Prince Fahad who had the final say on policy. At times, the Saudi policies infuriated the other exporters enough to bring down a rain of vituperation, often carefully directed toward Yamani and not the royal family. "When you listen to Iranian radio or read Iranian newspapers, you will learn that I am a devil," Yamani complained. One of the leading newspapers in Tehran castigated Yamani as a stooge of capitalist circles and a traitor not only to his own king and country, but also to the Arab world and the Third World as a whole.